From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Mystic River, the new film directed by Clint Eastwood, is out in theaters. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with novelist Dennis Lehane about writing Mystic River, the book on which the film is based. Also, an uncensored history of Saturday Night Live. We talk with Tom Shales and James Miller about their book on SNL. It's now out in paperback. Rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album by the band Outkast. And film critic David Edelstein reviews Kill Bill, the new film by Quentin Tarantino. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Vice President Dick Cheney said today that it would have been reckless in the extreme for the United States to wait before taking action against terrorists and their supporters, including Saddam Hussein. NPR's Pam Fessler has more.
The vice president made his remarks at the Heritage Foundation, a conservative think tank. It was part of an administration offensive to counter growing criticism of its policies in Iraq. Cheney said U.S. security would have been endangered if Saddam Hussein had been allowed to stay in power. He said preemptive action was needed to prevent the Iraqi leader from someday supplying terrorists with weapons of mass destruction.
There is only one way to protect ourselves against catastrophic terrorist violence, and that is to destroy the terrorist before they can launch further attacks against the United States.
The administration's claims that Saddam had an active weapons of mass destruction program have been widely challenged, but the vice president said evidence of such efforts has been and will continue to be uncovered. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
President Bush said today that he's taking tougher steps against the government of Cuban President Fidel Castro. Speaking to a White House audience that included Cuban exiles and Cuban-American politicians, the president said he has directed Secretary of State Colin Powell and Housing Secretary Mel Martinez to lead a commission to prepare for the day that Castro leaves power.
They will draw upon experts within our government to plan for Cuba's transition from Stalinist rule to a free and open society, to identify ways to hasten the arrival of that day.
President Bush also said that he'll enforce laws banning Americans from vacationing in Cuba and will make it easier and safer for Cubans to come to the U.S. Earlier this week, the Cuban government complained that President Bush has become more aggressive toward Cuba in a bid to win votes from Cuban exiles in Florida. In the Middle East today, an Israeli military raid left 6 Palestinians dead and scores injured. The raid took place in an area near the border with Egypt. The Israeli army says the violence erupted as its troops attempted to shut down tunnels used to smuggle arms. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
The Israeli army says that it's part of their routine operations to try to stop terrorism. They say that the Palestinian Authority is not doing what it should, so that the Israeli army has to do it, and that the Rafah refugee camp is known for having tunnels that are used for smuggling weapons from Egypt into Gaza and then into the West Bank, so that they were targeting these tunnels going house to house. And they said, an army spokesman said, they try to avoid any civilians getting killed, and that they fired a missile at Palestinian gunmen, not at civilians.
NPR's Linda Gradstein. The Dow lost 5 points to close at 96.74. This is NPR News. Eugene Istomin has died. The classic pianist was 77. Joel Rose reports from member station WHYY.
Eugene Istomin was 18 years old when he debuted with the Philadelphia Orchestra and the New York Philharmonic in the same week. Istomin gave more than 4,000 concerts on 6 continents and made dozens of records. In particular, his 1960s trio recordings with violinist Isaac Stern and cellist Leonard Rose are widely celebrated. A child of Russian immigrants, Eugene Istomin was born in New York City. He entered the Curtis Institute of Music in Philadelphia at 12, studying with pianist Rudolf Serkin. Istomin's widow, Marta, is president of the Manhattan School of Music. They had no children. Cause of death was cancer of the liver. For NPR News, I'm Joel Rose in Philadelphia.
A federal judge in Tampa, Florida, has refused to block the removal of a feeding tube from a severely brain-damaged woman. The judge had said he had no jurisdiction in the case of Terry Schiavo, whose feeding tube was scheduled to be removed next Wednesday. Schiavo, who's 39, has been in a coma since suffering a heart attack 12 years ago. Her husband, Michael, has been fighting to have her feeding tube removed, saying that she would never have wanted to be kept alive by artificial means. Terry Schiavo's parents say therapists have told them that their daughter could regain consciousness and could be taught to eat and possibly even to speak. Stock prices showed little change today on Wall Street. The Nasdaq Composite Index gained 3 points to close at 1,915. The Nasdaq was up 1.8% for the week. The S&P 500 lost a fraction to close at 1,038. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Sodexo, embracing the diversity of more than 100,000 employees across America and the people they serve. SodexoUSA.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. The Clint Eastwood thriller Mystic River opened this week. It stars Sean Penn as a man whose daughter has been murdered, and Lawrence Fishburne and Kevin Bacon as detectives assigned to the case.
We've been interviewing witnesses, canvassing people that might have been in the bar. We've run into more than a few of them who were questioned before us by one or more of the Savage brothers.
So the Savages are not policemen, Jim?
Yeah, some people don't talk to policemen, Sean. With all due respect, Mr. Markham, and just so we're clear, this is our case.
How long?
How long what?
How long before you catch my daughter's killer, I need to know.
Are you bargaining with us?
Bargaining?
You giving us a deadline? We'll speak for Katie, Mr. Markham, if that's okay with you.
You just find my daughter's killer, Sergeant. I'm not standing in your way.
Dennis Lehane wrote the novel on which the film is based. He's best known for his series of Private Eye novels featuring the team of Patrick Kenzie and Angie Gennaro. But Mystic River isn't part of that series and isn't a Private Eye novel. It begins in 1975, when three boys are fighting in the street and a couple of cops drive by to break it up. Two of the boys flee. The third is picked up by the cops, who actually turn out to be child molesters posing as cops. The boy is released after several days and returns home traumatized. The story picks up 25 years later and follows the lives of the three childhood friends. Terry spoke with Lehane in 2001 after Mystic River came out. She asked him if the abduction in the novel relates to anything that happened to him as a child.
No, I'm not a big believer in autobiographical fiction, if you will. I believe in the place and the flavor of the world you grew up in, but I don't believe in the particulars. I don't believe in, oh, remember when, you know, Johnny Sullivan did this and he had this certain way of smiling. Let's take that and put it in a book. I don't do that. But I do try and capture sort of, again, the texture and the flavor of the world I grew up in. This incident happened actually to myself and a friend of mine who were, not quite arrested, but we were taken off the street and we were getting in a fight and we were kids. And in the sort of heat of the moment, neither of us thought to ask for a badge. They turned out the gentlemen were cops, but that was something that always stuck in my head, I think, because my mother looked so terrified.
She suspected that maybe they weren't cops?
No, she just didn't. She thought the whole incident seemed weird mm-hmm. at the time. It turned out they were police officers, everything, but I'll never forget the fear when, she said, you saw their badge, right?
No, it's this abduction that sets everything in motion in your new novel.
Yep.
There's sexual abuse in an earlier book, Gone Baby Gone, where
yep.
a child's abducted. You worked briefly, I think, counseling children who
yes.
have been abused. What kind of work did you do?
I was a therapeutic counselor in a treatment facility. We would take kids from, review files in juvenile hall, and we would pick kids who we thought were sort of in the gray area between when a victim turns into a victimizer. And we would try and get them before they turned into victimizers and help them. And that was what we did. And that was the place I worked.
What are some of the things you learned during that experience that you used in your writing?
Well, I think I remember a woman I was dating at the time said, that she had never seen me angry until I took this job. you know, that I was a pretty, you know, even keel type of guy. So I discovered a capacity for anger at I think just the waste that I'd see. I also discovered a very sort of dirty secret of social work, which was, you know, 9 out of 10 times it's the parent. You can trace it back to the parent. A bad seed is a very rare thing. And it's not society, and it's not Marilyn Manson, and it's not, you know, it's kids who were abused or kids who were neglected or kids who were badly parented who turn out to be, you know, the kind of kids who shoot up schools or the kind of kids who become bullies or become murderers, become anything. And then it just depends upon the level of abuse. That can dictate a lot of things, because if the humanity is beaten out of you or sexually exploited out of you, then it's silly to expect that humanity will be recovered.
My guest is writer Dennis Lehane. Your new novel, Mystic River, is different from your other novels in that although there are crimes at its center, it's not about private detectives, and it's not part of your private detective series. Why was it time for you now to get out of that series and write a book that's independent of that?
Oh, I think it just, a lot of times it's just dictated by, you know, I wish we had a word for it, the inspiration, whatever you want to say. I was not inspired to write a book in the series. There was nothing there. The well was dry. And this book had been sort of gently rapping on the window for about 5 or 6 years. And then it began to really bang on the door about 2 years ago.
What was the message as it was banging?
You know, make a hole, make it wide, let us in. I always start with characters. I very rarely have a plot.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was just the characters. And there was this one line, Brendan Harris loved Katie Marcus like crazy, loved her like movie love. And that line just kept spinning around in my head for years. I mean, 5 years probably. And then gradually I got the second line, which was, it occurred to him as he was shaving that he was evil. And those two lines began to sort of become the the building blocks of the book.
And where do they actually turn up in the book?
Brendan Harris loved Katie Marcus like crazy is the very first line of the present day, first chapter in present day. That's the first line of chapter 3, which is the first chapter in the 2000 section. And then it occurred to him while he was shaving that he was evil shows up in the last chapter.
So let me ask you to read that line that first came to you before the novel was written. And now it's that first line in the first chapter set in the present.
Sure. Brendan Harris loved Katie Marcus like crazy, loved her like movie love, with an orchestra booming through his blood and flooding his ears. He loved her waking up, going to bed, loved her all day and every second in between. Brendan Harris would love Katie Marcus fat and ugly. He'd love her with bad skin and no breasts and thick fuzz on her upper lip. He'd love her toothless. He'd love her bald. Katie, the trill of her name sliding through his brain was enough to make Brendan feel like his limbs were filled with nitrous oxide, like he could walk on water and bench press an 18-wheeler, toss it across the street when he was finished with it. Brendan Harris loved everyone now because he loved Katie and Katie loved him. Brendan loved traffic and smog and the sound of jackhammers. He loved his worthless old man who hadn't sent him a single birthday or Christmas card since he'd walked out on Brendan and his mother when Brendan was 6. He loved Monday mornings and standing in line at the RMV. He even loved his job, though he wouldn't be going in ever again.
So you used that sentence, that first sentence that came to your mind, to very good effect in this passage that you just read. Have you ever had a first sentence that came to your mind that you ended up not using by the time you actually got to writing the book?
Oh, yeah. I think that... so often you start with something and all it is a way to get you into a book. Like my next novel, which I've begun, I sort of already know that the first 10 pages I've written will never make the book, you know, but I had to put it in to sort of figure things out for myself. And the trick is you fall in love with some of the sentences and you just got to remember that Orwell line, you know, murder your darlings.
Right.
So...
What do you like about writing familiar characters when you are writing your Private Eye series?
Oh, it's wonderful because I think the same reason readers read these books is because gradually there becomes this almost tender familiarity with these people. And they're like old friends. And it's like saying, come on by, have a drink, you know? You say, come on into the book. Oh, we haven't seen him in a while. We haven't seen him in 400 pages since, you know, book number four.
What are the limitations?
The reason I read and the reason I write is to discover things about characters. Plot is just a vehicle to do that. That's all plot is. It's just the actions by which a character is explicated. And I think gradually, the more you write about a character, the less you don't know about them. And the more you read about a character, the less you don't know about them. And that's why I think that it's very rare you hear somebody speak about a series and say, yeah, but the 15th book is the best. Nobody ever says that. They always say the fifth book is the best or the third book is the best. And I think that's because the characters have become overly familiar. And there is no sense of a journey. There are no epiphanies left to have about this person. So I think that's the point when you got to pull the plug.
Right.
I don't know if I've reached that point yet. I don't think I have, but I think I'm near it.
Dennis Lehane speaking with Terry Gross in 2001. We'll be back with more of their interview after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with more of Terry's interview with Dennis Lehane, whose book Mystic River has just been made into a film by Clint Eastwood.
Did you have any relatives who were cops? Or,
no.
Or friends' fathers who were cops? Not to just dwell on cliche, but you grew up in an Irish neighborhood, and you know a lot of, particularly when you were growing up, probably a lot of Irish fathers were cops.
Oddly, no. no, not with my friends. I had one of my closest friends' uncle was a rather prominent cop, mm-hmm. but I had very little contact with him. My wife's family are all cops, but I didn't grow up around cops. I grew up around laborers, you know. Mm-hmm. My father worked for Sears and Roebuck. Most of my friends' fathers worked, you know, they were truck drivers, occasionally a postman. But no, we didn't grow up with that law enforcement vibe around us.
Did your opinion of or relationship with cops change from childhood to adulthood?
No, I think one of the greatest things about growing up in the inner city, if you see it correctly, was that we always knew the places never to go and say drink, for example, when you're 17 years old, underage drinking or smoke pot or whatever. The places to never commit crimes were small towns. Because they always had the absolute toughest cops, because they had, our opinion at the time was, they had nothing better to do. Where in the inner city, we had police officers, and they were a lot of times putting their life, pretty much on the line. They were the ones dealing with gangs, they were the ones dealing with shootouts and homicides, etc. And so they tended to be very easy to deal with if you weren't in their face. And I think that was because they could sort of, they had a relative sense. So if they caught a couple of kids, underage kids drinking beer, they took your beer and they walked away. They didn't have anything to prove, I guess. So I think that gave me a respect for the city cop, for the guy who really has to go out and literally put his life on the line. Whereas small town police, to some extent, there's a bit of a Napoleon complex.
Dennis Lehane is my guest. There's a passage describing the neighborhood that the characters in your book grew up in that I'm going to ask you to read.
Sure. They all lived in East Buckingham, just west of downtown, a neighborhood of cramped corner stores, small playgrounds, and butcher shops where meat, still pink with blood, hung in the windows. The bars had Irish names and Dodge darts by the curbs. Women wore handkerchiefs tied off at the backs of their skulls and carried mock leather snap purses for their cigarettes. Until a couple of years ago, older boys had been plucked from the streets as if by spaceships and sent to war. They came back hollow and sullen a year or so later, or they didn't come back at all. Days, the mothers searched the papers for coupons. Nights, the fathers went to the bars. You knew everyone. Nobody, except those older boys, ever left.
Is that an accurate description of the neighborhood you grew up in?
Yeah, I think that's pretty close. If you look back, my brother and I were always stunned to look back at pictures taken of us in 71, 73, and we look like we just, you know, we stepped off Main Street in Mayberry. I mean, you know, we still had the buzz cuts, still, you know, the clothing was much more what you would think of in, say, 1963, Brooklyn, you know, just the look of everything. It was, you know, and then right, you know, right down the street, you know, a couple of miles away, essentially, there's you know, student sit-ins at Harvard. And Harvard Square looks like what you expect Harvard Square to look like circa 1971, 72. But none of that reached the neighborhoods.
What do you want to write about that neighborhood now?
In your 20s, if you're a writer, you spend a lot of your 20s discovering your strengths and your limitations. And what I discovered is while I could write about any place and do it adequately, the stuff that struck a chord that really reached people at a very gut level was the stuff I said in you know, inner city northeastern neighborhoods. Gradually you just go, you know, well, Fitzgerald never wrote about poor people really well, and Faulkner never wrote anything set outside of Mississippi that was any good, and so maybe that's my limitation. Maybe I shouldn't be trying on all these hats. Maybe I should go to my strength.
When you were a kid in the early 70s with the buzz cut, looking like you were in Mayberry RFD, what was your attitude about the college students protesting at Harvard? What did you think of them?
Oh, well, we had a very, I think, a very neighborhood attitude, which was, you know, this was also when busing was ripping the inner city apart. Mm-hmm. And there was this very, a siege mentality took over, because the attitude of the establishment, certainly the establishment newspapers, was that it was a racial issue, where the people who were in the neighborhoods felt it was much more of a class warfare issue. It was about people who didn't live in the neighborhoods making decisions that affected the neighborhoods, and then stepping back and letting the neighborhood suffer. And I think certainly the sense of the, you know, when you would see the news and we'd see what was going on at Harvard or what was going on at, you know, Berkeley out in California, wherever, there was a sense of they're dilettantes, you know. They're the fortunate sons, where the people who are truly suffering for this aren't protesting because they're dead or they're dying because they couldn't afford to go to college, etc. So I think that was certainly, there was never a sense in my neighborhood that anybody thought Vietnam was a good idea. You know, never. I remember it was very clear. My father was, you know, if my brother got to that age, which he neared just as the war ended, you know, my father was ready to put him on a plane to Canada.
The characters in your new novel, Mystic River, don't go home at night and, you know, read novels.
No.
were you a reader as a child? And
oh,
was
God.
That was that unusual in your neighborhood or in your family?
Yes, it was, in both. Well, my brothers were readers, my older brothers. They read a lot of, you know, S.E. Hinton and, you know, Robert Ludlum and things like that. There was reading, and my sister was read a lot of classics. So there was reading in my family, certainly. And I just picked it up at a much more ferocious clip. I mean, I started reading when I was six. My mother took me to the library when I was six. And it's still the most pivotal event in my life. You know, it changed everything. And so did it seem a little odd to the neighborhood? Yeah, definitely. But the great thing is that everybody was pretty cool about it, too. You know, it wasn't like everybody said, you know, oh, four. Well, I didn't wear glasses, but I wasn't ostracized for being a reader.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, you know, that Lahane kid's a little odd, you know, in the same way that you'd say it about the kid who would every winter would stick his tongue to the pole, you know.
Right.
It's a little, he's all right, but he's a little odd.
No, you've written or are writing, I believe, a screenplay based on one of your Private Eye novels?
Yes.
So do you have in mind the type of actor you'd like to play your Private Eyes, Patrick and Angie? And I'm wondering, do you want them to be ultra-attractive or just to have a lot of screen presence?
Oh, no, I like, I'm much more of a character actor guy. I like people who just, that whatever it is they got, nobody else has it, you know? I'm not talking star power, but say a guy like Will Patton, for mm-hmm. example. I don't even know if you know who that
yeah,
is.
Yeah, I do.
But now there's a guy, you put him on the screen, and you know nobody else is going to give a performance like him. Nobody. Will Patton is Will Patton, you know? I tend towards character actors, which would make me a very bad Hollywood producer because I wouldn't get necessarily bankable stars. I think a perfect Patrick would be Ray Liotta. Although he might be a few years older than him, I think he'd be great. But I don't think Hollywood considers him an A-list star, if you know what I mean. The way they would, say, a Ben Affleck.
Right.
Or a Tom Cruise or something like that. I have my theories, but I also know they're rather impractical.
Is the movie being made?
It's certainly in development with Paramount. I have to turn in the second draft of the script next week.
Oh.
So
okay.
So we'll see what happens with it, but it's not an experience. I think having done it and worked extremely hard on it, I don't think I would ever do it again.
Why
which
not?
Is adapt one of my novels. It's just too it's asking you to turn it into a Reader's Digest condensed book. You know, it's asking you to perform I wouldn't go so far as to say an abortion, but it's asking you to perform an operation in which large pieces are going to be removed. And the last person who should be asked to do that is the person who created that body in the first place.
So you worked so hard to get it right, and now you have to completely undo it.
Yeah, it's like books on tape, and they always ask me to approve the abridged copy.
Yeah.
And I always say on the phone, okay, it's approved. And they say, no, we're sending it to you. And I say, I'm just going to throw it away. I'm not going to look at it. I'm not even going to look at it for a second. Why would I do that? I just wrote a 400-page novel. Why would I look at, you know, 190-page abridgment? That's just insane. I understand from a business perspective why you must do this, and I have no problem with it. But don't ask me to sit there and read a butchering of my novel.
Dennis Lehane speaking with Terry Gross in 2001. His novel Mystic River has been adapted into a film. Lehane's newest book, Shutter Island, is also a departure from the work he's best known for, the Kenzie and Gennaro Private Eye series. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of The Stones of Summer, the novel that inspired the film Stone Reader, available October 22nd at Barnes & Noble stores and online at www.bn.com. From the University of Nebraska Press, publishers of Phantom Limb by Janet Sternberg, a memoir of an adult daughter confronting ghosts of the past during her parents' last years, available in paperback. By Calico Corners, your home for custom decorating, with over 100 stores across the country, on the web at calicocorners.com. And from Dutton Books, publisher of La Faire, a witty comedy of manners and culture clash by Diane Johnson, author of Le Divorce. An excerpt is available at authordianejohnson.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, behind-the-scenes stories about the making of Saturday Night Live. We talk with Tom Shales and James Miller. Also, Ken Tucker reviews the new album by the band Outkast, and David Edelstein reviews the new film by Quentin Tarantino. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley. Outkast's new release is an unusual double album. It's really two separate albums, one each by the group's two leaders, Andre 3000 Benjamin and Antoine Big Boy Patton. Big Boy's is called Speakerbox, and Andre's is called The Love Below. Rock critic Ken Tucker says the resulting package is music that is less schizophrenic than you might expect.
Girl, you could have.
The Atlanta, Georgia duo that forms the heart and brains of Outkast seems to be going in opposite directions this time around. On the track I just played, called Bowtie, Big Boy Patton hews closely to Outkast's roots in funk music, while Andre is going for something more pop, even acoustic, in a song like Hey Ya.
1, 2, 3, My baby don't mess around because she loves me so.
This is the opposite of a group effort. The Outkast members even recorded their albums in different parts of the country, Big Boy in Atlanta, Andre in Los Angeles. Big Boy's guiding musical mentor would seem to be George Clinton's P-Funk, while Andre is expanding his sound to include pop and jazz. In a charmingly self-indulgent moment, he offers a passable version of John Coltrane's version of My Favorite Things. But here's a musical quiz. Which one of them made this?
Today I might snow, tomorrow I'll rain. 3000's always changing, but you stay the same, and I need that. Hey, I need that.
In my life,
when I feel washed up and inadequate and throw all my songs away, no matter how mad I get, you make me smile. Make me smile, you make me smile, you make me. Oh, you're the anchor that holds me down. When my ship is sinking, you won't let me drown, and I'm grateful.
It turns out that that's Andre. But its gut bucket funkiness is a quality he still shares with Big Boy. They also share certain lyrical themes, such as an infatuation with women that expresses itself both romantically and sexually with a deceptively casual intensity. You never know what to expect listening to these two records. Big Boy raps hard, but he's never as hardcore as Andre is on the song called Spread. In the past, Outkast has evinced a gift for topical material that pays off as music as well as message. I'm thinking of songs like Rosa Parks and the prescient Bombs Over Baghdad. On their new effort, music itself is most often the subject, exercises in genre, as in this bit of funky gospel called Church.
Sometimes life can keep you down with your face all in the dirt. But if you feel that left behind, need to get up and go to church.
To the mode, time to drop a load. My life is going downhill like some cardboard in the snow. My bank account is frozen. I don't think that I can get out this hole. Feel like the figure four leg, like the jury went away and then they came back deadlocked. I can't move, I can't eat, I can't.
can't even breathe. Can't even buy your decent sack without the stems and the seeds. No trees, no peas to ease. The stress of everyday living. But homeless people gotta suck it up wherever they live in. The unforgiving or the unwilling. Live a life of sinning and expect to be as pure as an infant in the beginning. But
what about repenting?
What about detention? What about you eating dinner in the devil's kitchen?
What about repenting?
What about committing the same sin over and over again and again and again and again and again?
Although they're doing interviews saying things like Outkast is forever and it's about growing up, not breaking up, Andre and Big Boi are giving these interviews separately. And while Big Boi is happy to continue to find new crunchiness in nuggets of hip-hop, Andre is striving for a new ambitiousness, recently insisting that hip-hop has to move on. His comparison was that hip-hop is to jazz as his new music is to bebop, more experimental, yet still playful and tuneful. I hope these two guys stay together, because they're never as good as when they're making music from inside an Outkast framework.
Ken Tucker is critic-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed the new double CD album from Outkast. Coming up, Uncensored SNL. This is Fresh Air. Saturday Night Live, the late-night NBC variety show that began in 1975, is now a TV institution. Tom Shales and James Andrew Miller have written a new book about that institution called Live from New York, An Uncensored History of Saturday Night Live, as told by its stars, writers, and guests. It's now out in paperback. Shales, who won a Pulitzer Prize for his TV criticism in the Washington Post, is one of the few TV critics still working who was around when the show premiered 28 years ago. I'm another one, but I digress. Shales also reviewed movies for NPR's Morning Edition. Miller has written for TV and the movies and is the author of a book about the Senate. Both Miller and Shales think the funniest SNL cast was the original one. Dan Aykroyd, John Belushi, Chevy Chase, Jane Curtin, Garrett Morris, Lorraine Newman, and Gilda Radner. Here's some of their work.
Yes?
Mrs. Arlsberg?
Who?
Mrs. Borovnia.
Who is it?
Flowers.
Flowers for whom?
Plumber, ma'am.
I don't need a plumber. You're that clever shark, aren't you?
Candy Graham.
I just think that, well, you should from now on try to do your best, okay?
Oh, yes, dear, and I'm very, very sorry, and I promise from now on I will do my best.
See that you do.
Bitch.
I'm gonna get me a shotgun and kill all the whiteys I see.
Eggs, couple of eggs, eggs, couple of eggs, an oval lightly with sausage, café, café.
No eggs.
When do you stop serving breakfast?
No breakfast.
Nope. Fine. I just want a couple of eggs.
No breakfast, cheeseburger, huh?
I don't want a cheeseburger.
Come on, don't give me that. Come on, let's go. We gotta have turnover. We want a cheeseburger? Come on, everybody get a cheeseburger. You want a cheeseburger? Come on, cheeseburger.
I don't want a cheeseburger. It's too early for a cheeseburger.
Too early for a cheeseburger? Look, cheeseburger.
Terry spoke with Tom Shales and James Miller last year when their book, Live from New York, An Uncensored History of Saturday Night Live, was first published.
one thing that seems consistent through the years on Saturday Night Live is that there's always one or two people who are telling you about how they'd go home at night and just cry because it was so frustrating. Either nothing was being written for them or what they were writing wasn't getting on or they felt that things were too competitive and they weren't looking good. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, Lorne has always operated a competitive ship, and the competitiveness is built into it, and people who can't take it do sort of fall by the wayside.
It is not a nurturing environment. If you are a person that craves feedback, you're at the wrong place.
And Lorne is notorious for withholding praise. Whether he does this as part of a strategy, whether it's just part of his natural sort of shyness and standoffishness, I don't know, but... He is not the easiest person in the world to work for. On the other hand, he can be very caring and attentive to people and their problems. And this has endeared him to many of those who work there now and many of those who worked there in the past. And even people he's fired in the book say nice things about him. Yeah, sure, he fired me, but I still admire him. I find that quite amazing. I find Lorne quite amazing.
One of my favorite things that Conan O'Brien said was that when he was a writer on the show, he would be walking down the hall and Lorne would pass him and just look at him and say, "Still with the show, Conan?" You know, it's that kind of environment.
Saturday Night Live has had its ups and downs over the years. What do you consider the worst year or the worst cast?
I think that there was probably, in my opinion, I guess there were two. One was the cast that started in 1980 when Gene Demanian took over after Lorne and the original cast had left. And that was when she was going to build the show around Charlie Rocket, which that was...
the rocket that never launched.
The rocket that never launched. And then in 1985, Lorne's first year back, he had decided to take a page from Dick Ebersol, who the year before had, rather than pick unknowns, he had put together like Billy Crystal and Marty Short and Chris Guest. That was a fantastic year. But the next year, 1985, Lorne picked a bunch of people who really weren't ready for Saturday Night Live, even though they had done other movies. And Michael Hall was in that, and Randy Quaid. And
it was a weird grab bag. And Al Franken told us one of the problems was you couldn't do a Senate sketch. You couldn't do a presidential political sketch because there were nobody to play those parts. They were just either these untried kids, including Robert Downey Jr., who tried many things as the years would go by, or else Randy Quaid, who stuck out like the proverbial sore thumb. It was a weird group. Now, I would completely agree with Jim on those were the two worst casts.
It's funny because Robert Downey Jr. and Randy Quaid are both really good actors, although they didn't work on Saturday Night Live very well.
Well, that's part of the legacy of Saturday Night Live as well, because look at Julia Louis-Dreyfus, who is incredibly talented and kept us laughing for 10 years on Seinfeld. She was on Saturday Night Live and, you know, really was like a Porsche going 40 miles an hour. She never, ever really got to do anything that showed her talents. And anybody looking at her during her time there would have thought, you know, well, this is just somebody who's really not going to make it. Luckily, Larry David, who created Seinfeld, was one of the writers at that time. And he saw something in her that, you know, you really couldn't see from the sketches. Sometimes Saturday Night Live is not the best vehicle for figuring out whether somebody's truly talented.
But, you know, remember Bill Murray, it took months for Bill Murray to finally put himself over on the air. And one way he had to do it was to sit down and talk into the camera and say, "My name is Bill Murray. I'm not really making it on the show. I don't quite understand why." And he had this little dialogue with viewers, and it worked. And then suddenly his kind of character was something new, and people began to see what was funny about it. And today, I would say the most imitated performer in the history of Saturday Night Live, and I may be wrong, is Bill Murray. You can still see on ESPN, in commercials, on other sitcoms, there's always a guy trying to be that kind of hip, disconnected, irreverent, super cool guy that Bill Murray played way back when. He was the prototype. I think he invented a new comic character, and it's become just part of American folklore.
One of the more bizarre moments on Saturday Night Live was a few years ago when the singer Sinead O'Connor, after doing a song, held up a photo of the Pope or a picture of the Pope and then tore it to shreds in front of the camera. Something I understand was not rehearsed. What was that about? What happened behind the scenes afterwards?
Well, the first thing that happened was Dave Wilson, who was the director, made sure that they didn't push the applause sign. So there was dead silence in Studio 8H. It was a terrifying moment for a lot of people there because it was so unexpected. She had not told anyone, and not even Lauren. I mean, no one expected it. And she had just done the dress rehearsal about an hour before, and, you know, everything was fine. And then she said during, between dress and air, that she was going to show something at the end of her song, and so she wanted the director to be aware of that so they would get the close-up.
I think she specified a picture of a hungry child or something.
Right.
Yeah. And
right.
They even had one at dress rehearsal. They had a picture of a hungry child.
But no one knew what she was going to do, so the media reaction was just, you know, nobody could believe it happened. The great thing about Lauren, though, afterwards, instead of being really ticked, he said, well, that was awfully courageous of her. And he just... Somehow he saw the, you know, her gumption, and
he admired the gesture, but he did not admire being tricked or being lied to. That made him mad, and they had set it up so methodically, where they said, now can you just have it one camera on her, not, you know, don't have any other cameras to switch to, so they were trapped with one shot of Sinead O'Connor. The only thing they could have gone to would have been a reaction shot of the audience, which would have been worse, I suppose, at that point when she tore up the picture. So. Lauren may have admired the gesture in a philosophical way, but they were just furious that she would lie to them and trick them. And I don't think she's ever been invited back. In fact, her career didn't exactly skyrocket after that.
I bet one of the things you asked a lot of people from Saturday Night Live was to share their nightmare moments, the moment that was just like the worst moment of their career on Saturday Night Live. Can you tell us about a couple of the nightmare moments?
Actually, a lot of the nightmare moments on the show wind up happening behind the scenes. I think that when you get to the sketch stage of the show, when you're live at 11:30, things are pretty well nailed down.
Lauren doesn't like ad-libbing, and he doesn't like breaking up over a sketch, and he thinks it looks phony. And so when that happens, I think he sometimes chastises people. But on the other hand, sometimes it's so good-natured and inescapable. You know, Brendan Fraser was on and his wig fell off and drooped down over his head, and somehow they all got the giggles, and the audience began to laugh. The audience likes being there when something goes wrong because they think they're privy to this secret information, which of course is going out to 14 million homes. But anyway, it seems like something. You know, these days, if you watch Saturday Night Live live, you may see that show, you may see the show that way that time only. It may never again be repeated in that form, because if something does go wrong, Lauren now has the option. They tape every dress rehearsal, so he has the option of pulling the sketch out of dress rehearsal and plopping it into the space where it was in the live show. He can re-edit shows for when they're rerun later. And so Saturday Night Live is still an event in the sense that this could be the only time the show is performed exactly that way, complete with those mistakes. I remember once they did, this sounds so trivial, and it is, but they did a sketch with that horrible Tom Green, who brought his own writers, and nobody liked him. But anyway, they had a little baby pig in this sketch, and the pig squealed and squealed and squealed and seemed so unhappy and miserable. And I was at home, and I was furious, thinking, you know, it's not funny to torture any animal, even a pig. And Lauren had an angry letter from some girl, a little girl in the audience, posted outside his office for weeks after that. Well, anyway, that was never seen again, because they simply threw that out and picked up the same sketch from the dress rehearsal where the pig was not in distress and plopped that into the space where it had been. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Did they ever rerun the show with Sinead O'Connor? And what did they do with that?
Yeah, they rerun it all right, but they put the dress rehearsal performance in.
Huh.
So never again will you see her, except in a news program, in news footage, never will you see in a Saturday Night Live her tearing up a picture of the Pope.
Tom Shales, as a TV critic for The Washington Post, what do you think of Saturday Night Live now?
I love it. It's an amazing phenomenon. It's a cliche, but it reinvents itself all the time. and it has its down years, and then it bounces back up again. And yeah. I've never been one to get hysterical or, you know, to say that the world is ending like Chicken Little when they, you know, when they go through a slump, except for the time when Gene Dumanian took over the show. And I was proud of the lead I wrote for the, because everybody else was writing Saturday Night Dead. But what I wrote was Vile from New York. It's Saturday Night. I did an anagram. But that was the only time I lost all hope for the show. And even then, it came back. So I think the amazing self-rejuvenation properties of that show are very encouraging.
Tom Shales and James Miller speaking with Terry Gross in 2002. Their book, Live from New York, An Uncensored History of Saturday Night Live, is now out in paperback. Coming up, David Edelstein on Quentin Tarantino's new movie, Kill Bill. This is Fresh Air. It's been 6 years since Quentin Tarantino's last feature, Jackie Brown. He's back with an extravagantly bloody martial arts movie called Kill Bill, starring Uma Thurman as an avenging warrior known as the Bride. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
When he's told in one of his movies that sex without love is an empty experience, Woody Allen says, "Yes, but as empty experiences go, it's one of the best." And that's how I feel about Quentin Tarantino's fourth film, Kill Bill. That doesn't mean the movie is totally empty. It's just on the elemental end of the dramatic spectrum. It's about a woman, played by Uma Thurman, whose entire wedding party is slain by the Deadly Viper Assassination Squad, or Divas, which is commanded by a guy called Bill. We don't know what the pregnant bride did to merit execution, but we see enough shrieking flashbacks to know that the assault on her was bloody and protracted and excruciating. We know why, once the bride awakens from a 4-year coma, she wants to hack her way through all the divas, up to the title character, who put a bullet in her head. She doesn't make it to Bill in this volume, since Kill Bill was itself hacked into two parts when Tarantino and Miramax's Harvey Weinstein thought a 3-plus-hour gut-bucket revenge flick was a contradiction in terms. I agree. But it's important to say that for all its invocation of Hong Kong martial arts and Japanese shogun assassin pictures, Kill Bill doesn't replicate the 70s urban scuzzy grindhouse experience. It's too playful in form. Its narrative syntax is too artfully scrambled. It's too visually resourceful. It's too beautiful. What differentiates the movie from its models is the novice enthusiasm that Tarantino brings. He's never done pure action before. He kept the violence off-screen or at a distance in his last film, the funky and way underrated Jackie Brown. This time, he throws himself whole hog into the carnage. As the severed limbs fly, you can practically hear him cackle, "This is so cool." Uma Thurman isn't a typical martial arts heroine either. She's a tall woman, and she doesn't have that superhuman nimbleness of Beijing opera-trained fighters. But I loved watching her. The character's strain and the actress's strain are in sync. Here she is confronting her Volume 1 nemesis, a ganglord called O Ren, played by Lucy Liu. The bride has just divested about 30 of O Ren's henchmen of their limbs, using a sword handmade by a character played by Tarantino's idol, Sonny Chiba. You'll hear some really loud clattering sounds in the middle. That's about 60 more assassins pouring into the room.
So, O Ren, any more subordinates for me to kill? Think it was going to be that easy, did you? You know, for a second there? Yeah, I kind of did. Silly rabbit. Tricks are for kids.
That's some pretty campy dialogue, but the rest of the movie isn't quite so obvious. In an early scene, the bride kills one of her adversaries in front of the woman's young daughter, and the moment hangs, ugly and unresolved. The bride tells the little girl that if she's still feeling raw in a few years, she can come for her. Then there's a flashback. It's animated, in the style of a Japanese anime, in which we learn that Lucy Liu's O Ren became an assassin after avenging her own parents, who were murdered in front of her eyes. It's like a revenger's tragedy Hall of Mirrors. The heroine of one vigilante saga becomes the villain of the next. Kill Bill will not be to everyone's taste. I've read some tut-tut reviews, like the one by David Denby in The New Yorker that ends, "I felt nothing, not despair, not dismay, not amusement, nothing." Well, I felt glee. I felt the way I sometimes do at a Mark Morris dance piece that reshuffles a lot of familiar showbizzy moves into something new and funny and unexpectedly gorgeous. Kill Bill literally becomes a dance movie in the course of the final battle. The lights go out, and the bride and a horde of masked assassins are suddenly blue silhouettes gyrating against a great grid. It's an American in Paris with arterial spray.
David Edelstein reviews films for Fresh Air and the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Herzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancoulet.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by Barnes & Noble Books, publishers of Dow Osmond's The Stones of Summer, inspiration for the film Stone Reader, available at Barnes & Noble bookstores and online at bn.com, by the University of Alabama School of Law, shaping the next generation, on the web at alabamalawschool.com, and from Dutton Books, publisher of La Faire, A Comedy of Manners and Culture Clash by Diane Johnson, author of Le Divorce. An excerpt is available at authordianejohnson.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Carol Burnett talks about her life and work. Her memoir, One More Time, has just been reissued. Join us for the next Fresh Air.